Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is Debug Tool for COS. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's session, we will start off by introducing to you our panel of experts. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to Debug Tool for COS. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us through email. Then, we will open the lines for live Q&A period. And finally, the session will end with a summary of today's webcast. Moving on to slide number 3. At this time, I would like to introduce to you our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Bill Majak, Debug Tool Support Engineer.
Hi, my name is Bill Majak, and welcome to the call. I've been with IBM for over 23 years, all in the area of technical support.
Thank you, Bill. Next, we have Randy Kramer, Debug Tool Development Engineer.
Hello, this is Randy Kramer. I'd like to welcome everybody to the call. I've been with IBM a little over 33 years, and I've been on Debug Tool for about 15 years. And I'm with Level 3, the development group.
Thank you, Randy. Next, we have Randy Campbell, Debug Tool Development Engineer.
Hi, this is Randy Campbell. I have been with IBM for 24 years and with Debug Tool for 5. And I work with Randy on service work and primarily with the BTAM component, the SVCs, and the overlay hook handling support.
Thank you, Randy. Next, we have Jason Liu, Debug Tool Support Engineer.
Hi, this is Jason Liu. I've been with IBM for 30 years and currently work on Debug Tool Level 2 support. I've been with this job for 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Then we have Shauna Hogan, Debug Tool Development Engineer. And finally, we have Jesse Jackson, Debug Tool Development Engineer.
Hello, my name is Jesse Jackson. I've been with IBM and Debug Tool for about 11 years, and my focus is on remote debug and the workstation user interfaces.
Thank you, Jesse. So before we get to the question and answer period, our panel would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. Moving on to slide number 4, and please go ahead, Bill.
Hi. What we plan to cover in this session is just some of the common questions and problems that we see in Debug Tool that get submitted to us via PMRs or other means. One of the first topic is locating files for the Debug Tool. How does Debug Tool locate the files? Second question, what are some of the changes to the Terminal Interface Manager and how do they affect VTAM? Next question is what are some of the advantages of using the Debug Tool GUI plugin? Next question is what are some of the recommendations for DTCN panels for debugging under CICS? And finally, how does one go about debugging a non-LE program? Moving on to the next slide.
Okay, this is Randy Kramer, and I'll be handling question 1 and a couple other questions as we go along. The first question is, how does Debug Tool locate the source, listing, or separate debug files? Please move to slide 6. I'm sure nobody's has ever had this occur where Debug Tool comes up and the source window is empty, which normally means Debug Tool could not find your source, listing, or separate debug file depending on how you compiled your program. if this ever happens, the best thing to do is really consult the user's guide in Appendix B. Appendix B is about 5 or 6 pages, and I've highlighted some things on the next couple slides, and then on the third slide, I'm going to give you some things to check other than Appendix B. But basically, Appendix B, the reason it's 5 or 6 pages is that many of these things are language-dependent. So the way Debug Tool searches and where it looks for files is definitely language-dependent. And Debug Tool normally always looks at a default location inside the actual load module, depending on how you compiled your program. It looks for, like, the listing name. If you have a sysprint DD name, the name that you specify there will get put in the load module, and that's where Debug Tool will first attempt to look, or if you use a sysdebug DD card. And, again, that default name is language and compiler dependent. And so that's where it's going to look first. The other thing is, if it doesn't show up, you have several commands that you can use to find the source listing or sysdebug file. And some of them are listed here. There's the set source command, set default listings command. There's the EQA debug DD statement. There's an EQA UE dat user exit. Now, the user exit, we give you a sample for that, and then you have to customize it, indicating if the file was put here, I want to change the name to this. So you can use various commands to tell Debug Tool where the source listing or sysdebug file is. And for any of these commands, I would suggest going to the reference and manual message for additional information on how these commands are entered, the syntax of them. And for things like set default listings, you can either use like a DD name or one or more data set names. Also, for like C and C++, there's environment variables, and depending on if you're using .dbg files or .mdbg files, there's different DDs and set commands for those. Please navigate to slide 7, please. Now, I gave one example here specifically for COBOL and Enterprise PL1 separate debug files. Like I said, Appendix B has things for C, C++. It goes through a lot of things. But here is the priority if you're dealing with COBOL and PL1 separate debug files, not source or listing, but separate debug files. The first thing is it's going to look at the set source command. Now, obviously, if Debug Tool is not up yet, the only way it's going to find the set source command, it would have to be in something like a global preference or a user preference file. Other than that, you won't be able to issue that command until Debug Tool starts up and you see the empty source window. But if you know you want to use that command, you could put it in a global or a user preference file. The next place Debug Tool will look for COBOL and PL1 is in the default dataset name. Again, that would be when you compile your program using the sysdebug DD. It will look for that name. Now, if you do not have an EQA debug DD statement and you do have a EQA UE dat user exit, then it's possible this default name could be modified and changed, so the exit would change the default name to some other name where you want it to look. Third, it will look in the set default listings command. Again, this command, you'd have to enter it either as a global preference or a user preference type file, so Debug Tool sees it before it comes up. Otherwise, you can issue it from the command line. And again, the same thing applies here for the EQA debug DD statement in the EQA UE dat user exit. So the name could get changed by the exit. And lastly, it'll look for the EQA debug DD statement. If you would, navigate to slide 8, please. In this slide, I think, is probably maybe the most important one here other than looking at the appendix. I just want to give you a few things that you could do if you do encounter nothing in the source window when Debug Tool comes up. First, you should look at the message that's presented in the Debug Tool log and look that message up in the reference and message book. Now, if you don't want to search through the reference and message book, I would always suggest that you put set message ID on in like a global preference file. That way any messages you get will be prefixed with EQA. So when the message is written to the log, you will see EQA with some number following it, and it makes it easy to find in the book. In the reference and message book, there should be, it should tell you why you got the error message and hopefully some suggestions as what you can do to maybe fix the problem. Another thing you can do is when debug tool's up and there's no source in the window, you can hit the PF4 command if you haven't changed the default, because the PF4 command is defaulted to the list command. If you change the PF4 command, you can always type list on the command line. And what that does is it navigates you to something called the source identification panel. And I've placed a snippet of the source identification panel on this slide. And what this panel tells you, it associates a compile unit name with the listing source or sysdebug file. And so the name that's here, if we take like the second one, this is where debug tool is looking for that file or thinks that's where it is. If it doesn't find it, you need to look at that name. Like here, it's tskraem.p89830.sysdebug with a member name. If for some reason that file is not in that data set, you can overtype the name here. Everything that's in red, I'm going to call it red, you can overtype. And you can just overtype it and then exit this panel, and it actually will issue the set source command for you. If that name is where your source listing or sysdebug file is located, you may need to go in the TSO and look at that data set to make sure that member exists or if you even have access to browse it. Also, the very last column is the display column. Make sure that it has a Y in it so it gets displayed. If you put a no there, then it will not display it, even if you have the right name. So that's also an easy way to list the set source command, is just by overtyping this. You can overtype one character or as many as you need, but when you PF3 out of here, debug tool will actually invoke the set source command and put it in your log file. If you still don't have the source, you might want to issue the describe program command. This command will give you certain details about how you've compiled your programs, the options you use. Specifically, you want to look at the test option to see how you compiled the program. Next, you might want to check the system log or the job log or the Kix log, depending on the environment you're running in, for any specific messages, specifically those that start with EQA. You may see a message in there that you don't have RACF authority to that particular data set or something like that. Next, if you are under CICS, you might want to issue the DTSI transaction. This is basically an informational diagnostic type transaction. And when you issue it, it will come up and either say no significant errors found or if there were errors found. If there are errors found, then you want to browse the EQA info TSQ and look through there to see where the errors are flagged, and you should fix that. If all else fails, a lot of people don't like to run installation verification programs. They like to get right down into the meat of their program that they're actually going to try to run, which may be like a Kix IMS DB2 type program. And I would suggest if you can't see the source that you rerun or run for the first time the installation verification program, what we call the IVP. And there are various IVPs for batch, for Kix, and for all the different environments compiled different ways for the different languages. So if you run those and you still don't see the source, that basically indicates there's some type of setup problem, install or setup problem. And lastly, there's a special diagnostic runtime option called $DTRACC0. That last character is a zero. It's not an O. Normally, we would not have you run this. Normally, the support people would tell you to do this. And where the special actual runtime option goes is when you submit the test runtime option, this particular string can either be put in the command file or the preference file field. And what this will do is it'll put some WTOs out to either like the Kix log or the system console, and that will help us diagnose the problem. But the reason I put it on here is you could also use it if you are using an EQA UEDAT user exit, because this, if you have problems that your user exit does not seem to be changing the name to what you think it is or you don't think it's working, this will actually put WTOs out, which will show the parameters going into the user exit and the parameters coming out of the user exit. So it may give you an indication as to what's going in, and if you're expecting something out, you can look at these, the WTOs, to see if what's coming out is correct. So you might try that. But like I said, normally that provides a little bit more diagnostic information other than just the user exit. Normally you don't do that unless the service people tell you to do that. At this point, that's all I really have to say about question number one. So I will turn it over to the person doing question number two. So if you could please move to slide number nine, please.
Hello, everyone. This is Randy Campbell. I will be answering question number two, which is, how do the changes to TIM, our Terminal Interface Manager, affect VTAM? Please proceed to slide 10. Now, all of what is on this slide is basically what is required to set up the Terminal Interface Manager, starting with Debug Tool version 11. And if you're interested, if you're at version 10, this was also placed into a PTF for version 10. We call it PTF number 12. If you want information about the exact PTF number, or APAR number for that, we're going to give out an ID, or one of the participants is going to give you an ID where you can send offline kind of questions. So just wait for that if you're interested, and you can send it to Bill, who's going to be taking those questions, and he'll give you the information you need about that PTF. But in essence, what we have distilled the Terminal Interface Manager setup to are these four bullets. The first thing you need to do would be to define what we call in our books the debug tool minor nodes. They're actually application, VTAM application nodes. And they have to be this naming convention, EQA MV, and the NNN there are digits, 001 to 999. These are used to communicate between debug tool and either the Terminal Interface Manager or to the Terminal LU, where the debugging is going to take place. And these are basically hard-coded, this naming pattern, into debug tool. And so this definitely has to be defined exactly like this. You also have to define the application, the VTAM application, that corresponds to the Terminal Interface Manager itself. The default is EQA SESSM for the ACB name. That can be changed to whatever you want. There's a parameter you pass into TIM that tells that you can give it an alternate name. And there's also, you have to specify on the debug tool side via the EQA ops load module what you want to change that to, because both sides of the conversation have to know that new name. Then the next step, once you've got the application nodes defined, is to start the Terminal Interface Manager started task. The name of the load module is EQAYSESM, and there's something in the sample library. This is all discussed in Chapter 6 of the Version 11 Customization Guide, as an aside. And then once you've got the started task started, then people can connect and start logging on. But the final thing that you would need to do then is to give your users a way to bring up the Terminal Interface Manager. And I've just given some examples of what you might do, which is to add it as a session manager selection if you run with a session manager such as TPX or InVoS or something like that, IBM session manager, of course. You can also add it to an existing USS tab that someone would see when they connect to a SNA terminal, SNA terminal. Or you can add it, you can give instructions if you have USS Message 10 screen or a Telnet solicitor panel. You can give instructions for your users to connect that way, which is something like I've given you here, log on Apple ID, QAS, SESSM. That's basically it. That that's the essence of what version 11 going forward and version 10 PTF number 12 going forward. This is all you really need to have set up. So if we could go to slide 11, please. Now, these are the advantages for this new setup. Previous to this change, the VTAM terminals that you were going to use with TEM required a default log mode, what's called a default log mode to be specified, via the DLOG MOD parameter on the application definition statement in VTAM. And that's no longer required. If you're using TN3270, which a large number of people are, the port in use, the port that you would connect your terminal emulator to, the LU pool that it would use, that it would bring up, needed to specify this keep open parameter in the begin VTAM block, which was essential to the way that the support used to work. That's no longer required either. So the third bullet, basically, the summation of those two was that sites would have to set up a separate port, generally, because people just didn't want, and it was recommended in our books, to not share with the standard port 23, that you would have a separate port just for Terminal Interface Manager. And that made the installation quite a bit more difficult and quite a bit harder to get right on the first try. So eliminating that, eliminating all of those requirements, also allows Terminal Interface Manager to be included as a selection on just about any session manager. We used to restrict it to the IBM Session Manager with specific instructions for how to set that up, but that is basically no longer a restriction. That about sums it up. So if you could proceed to slide 12, please.
Hello, this is Jesse Jackson, and I'll be addressing question 3, which is, what are the advantages in using the new debug tool GUI plugin? If we could move to slide 13, please. So the debug tool plugin is an Eclipse-based plugin that allows you to debug host applications from a workstation user interface. This provides a flexible, customizable environment, which may be an easier transition for some new ZOS developers. Multiple applications can also be debugged simultaneously in the same interface. In addition to the debug tool plugin, we also have DTCN and DTSP plugins available. The DTCN plugin allows you to create and update DTCN profiles, and the DTSP plugin allows you to create and update test runtime option data sets. And all of this is done from the workstation. We can move to slide 14, please. Some of you may be familiar with older workstation interfaces. JSUI would be an example of this. This slide lists a few of several enhancements that have been made for this debug tool plugin. Starters, the debug console view, which provides a debug command line, now has a larger vocabulary along with a content assist. In addition to the expanded set of commands, you can now also set these commands to be triggered by breakpoints through this breakpoint action support that's been added. The variable and monitor views now can show you data types, and the variable view allows you to filter your results. So you could show items in COBOL working storage, or only data items that are in the previous or current statement, or a combination of these. So this is just kind of a very brief overview of the debug tool plugin. Thank you. Move to slide 15, please.
This is Randy Kramer again. I will be handling question 4. Question 4 is, with the changes to DTCN and debug tool version 10, are there recommendations on how the DTCN panel should be filled in? Could you please navigate to slide 16, please? Okay. Just hopefully everybody can see that. Just for a little background history here, the DTCN panel, if you look on the left, is what you would see with version 9, release 1. And specifically, I want to concentrate on in V9 was called the program ID. In earlier versions, even before this was implemented, there actually was only one program ID, but we had a request to have multiple program IDs for debug tool. And basically, when you list your program in there, these behave very similar to at entry type breakpoints. So debug tool will get control of these program IDs. Now, when we went to version 10, we had a request that some users needed a little bit more granularity, and they wanted to specify the load module and the CU, which is the compile unit, the load modules slash CU pair. And one of the reasons they wanted to do that is we had a few customers where they had a compile unit that was in several load modules, but they only wanted to debug one instance of that compile unit in one load module. They didn't want to debug and stop at all of them. So we ended up putting in load module CU. And on this panel, you can see it's load module 1, CU 1, load module 2, CU 2. Now, each pair of resources here is specified by load module colon colon greater than CU. And we've had some feedback that people don't like the colon colon greater than CU, but there is a reason we did it that way, is if you are in debug tool and you do a query location or something, that's how the output comes out. We use that syntax where you'll see load module colon colon greater than CU colon greater than block. So each pair here is load module CU. So that's what we're going to try to match on. And I think that's the only real difference here. And these are the ones we've had problems with because people have a hard time setting up their DTCN profile with these new fields. If I could get you to navigate now to slide 17. Okay. Again, if you want to go into the debug tool user's guide, there's some additional information on these fields, but I put a couple key things here from the usage notes on the panel. And the first one is if you specify the load module and leave the corresponding CU field blank, the CU field will default to an asterisk. We'll do that for you. So basically, you'll debug every CU in that load module. And it's just the opposite also. If you fill in the CU field and leave the load mod field blank, it will default to an asterisk. And I'll say a little bit more about that in just a minute. One of the other things to remember, if you leave all the load mods and CU fields blank, a lot of people, when they come into DTCN, they'll just hit PF4 to save what's called the default profile. And if you do that, the load mod and CU field will be blank. And at that point, debug tool will start up at the first program that's invoked. Now, bullet number 4 is probably, I think, the most important thing to remember here. We have very few people that actually have the situation where they have the same CU name in multiple load modules. So if you're used to using DTCN prior to version 10 and putting a program ID field in there, the way to get the same behavior is only fill in the CU field. Just let the load module field default to an asterisk. If you do that, you will get the same behavior you did with the version of DTCN prior to V10. And I would highly recommend you do that. Some people put they misread it. They put the name in the load module. The CU defaults to an asterisk, and they may or may not get control, and then they wonder what's going on. So that would be definitely the biggest thing I would like to point out for the new DTCN panel. Also, I've already mentioned this, but again, anything you put in this load mod CU field, it acts very similar to setting an at-entry breakpoint once debug tool is up. If I could get the operator to navigate to slide 18, please. Okay, what I did here is I wanted to provide, since the load module field is sort of a new field, I wanted to show you a little bit about what's on the help panel and what's in the user's guide. Because this is where sometimes people get confused, and that's why I say, for the most part, you should let this field default to an asterisk. The load mod name that you want to debug either can be any debug tool at initialization, It can be any Kix load module when it is invoked as a language environment enclave, which means it either needs to be the initial load module or a load module invoked by execkix link or execkix xctl. And for those not familiar, I call it Kix. You may prefer to call it CICS. Also, there was support added where we will also support an execkix load command here for non-language environment programs. The examples here, I specifically put this here just so you could look at it to help understand the load module field. And basically here, the example is we basically have CU1 in load module 1 links to a program CU2 in load module 2, and CU2 links to load module 3, which contains CU3, and it does a call, load module 4, which has CU4. And the call, if it's like COBOL or Enterprise PL1, that could be a static or a dynamic call. So the first example here is if you wanted to debug CU2, which is in load module 2, you could, for the load module CU pair, you could either put in load mod 2, :, greater than CU2, or you could fill in the CU name and leave the load module name blank, and it would default to an asterisk, which I think is easier to remember, and you'll see that on the next slide. Now, if you want to debug, or not the next slide, but the next example, if you wanted to debug CU4, which is in load module 4, a lot of people would think, oh, I need to put load module 4, :, greater than CU4 in the DTCN load mod CU field. Well, if you do that, debug tool will not stop. And the reason being is load mod 4 is not the initial load mod, and it's not a load module that was invoked by an execkix link or transfer control. Debug tool only knows what Kix knows about, and Kix does not know about things that are dynamically or static called for COBOL or Enterprise PL1. Consequently, what you would have to do here is either put load mod 3 CU4 in the profile, because load mod 3 is at a link level, or, again, the easiest way is just put CU4 in and let the load module default to an asterisk. And the last one is if you wanted to debug CU2 and CU4, you could either put in load mod 2, :, greater than CU2, and load mod 4, :, CU4, or you could put the CU names in and let the default go to asterisk. Now, you may have a question here. Well, now why are you putting load mod 4, :, greater than CU4? The reason being, and that's why I always recommend using asterisk for load module so you don't get confused, is debug tool in this case will start up for load mod 2, :, greater than CU2. Once debug tool is up, we now have the information in the back. Debug tool will understand and know about load modules and CUs at that point. But for the initial startup, like in example 2, the load module has to be at a link level. That's all I have to say about the new DTCN field. So if the operator could go to question 5, slide 19.
This is Randy Campbell again. I will be handling question number 5. What steps do I need to take to debug a non-LE program? Slide 20, please. Now, before executing your program that you want to debug, you need to build your program and build the debug data according to certain parameters. And the first step, obviously, is to compile and compile or assemble with the proper options. For older versions of COBOL, OS VS COBOL and VS COBOL 2, running without the language environment runtime, we have a Chapter 5 in our user's guide that explains how to compile both of those with the proper options. And really, the options that you need will produce the right kind of information in the output files, the listing, that then gets fed into the next step, which creates the debug data. So that's the key to getting the proper options, is that it gives us the data we need to build the debug data. The same goes with assembler test cases. that are non-language environment, or actually language environment too, because they also need this debug data, because language environment assembler does not generate debug data on its own. And so the assembler instructions are in Chapter 6, and the key there is to compile with the A data, or I'm sorry, assemble with the A data option and produce a SysA data file. Once that step is complete, then the second bullet here is that you have to create what's called the EQA-LangX debug data file. EQA-LangX is a program that we run that is identical to a program that's also available with our sister product, Fault Analyzer. And they call it IDI-LangX because their prefix is IDI. This is bitwise are the same programs, and they produce the same data. But in this case, we're calling it EQA-LangX, and depending on whether you're using COBOL or assembler, you would pass it either the listing file or the SysA data file, and it's going to generate the debug data that debug tool uses to bring in the source, the symbols, the path information, etc., that we need to allow you to debug. So slide 21, please. Now, once you've got it built correctly, I think this is the part that is perhaps the most confusing, is how to get debug tools started for a non-LE program. For language environment, it's pretty simple. You start the program, provide it with test options, and then the debugger will come up, presumably. It's a little more difficult for non-language environment programs if you want to start in the non-language environment program. For batch programs, the thing that you need to do is instead of calling your program, you would call something called EQA-NMDBG, which is kind of a front end to the process. It's a debug tool module, and you would pass the name of your application, what would normally be on the exec PGM equals statement. You would pass that program name as the first parameter. So parm equals your program name, comma, and then a test parameter. And there are a couple of other runtime parameters that you can specify as well. The one I've chosen here defaults the first three, the test level and the command file name and the prompt level, and then gives VTAM percent user, so that would be a terminal interface manager syntax. So you'd be sending the screen to a different terminal, and then asterisk for the preference file name. But this is the simple way of getting a non-LE program started under debug tool. You call EQA-NMDBG in batch. Now, there are variations of this for if you're running, you know, like a TSO session in batch. So you specify you would call EQA-NMDBG. And a lot of those are described in the user's guide for how to do that. Under CICS, it's a little bit different the way things work. We make use of the global user exits provided by CICS, notably the XP fetch exit. And what we've written are versions that allow us to see links transfer control. And as Randy alluded to, now we handle exec CICS load commands. When those get entered, we see that it's happened and can then get our hooks in and get the debugger started. And there are two ways to enable these user exits for non-LE. One is to use the sit parameter, this init parm, and then pass what we call the PLT, which is EQA0C PLT. It's a module of ours, and you pass it the parameter NLE, which will start these exits. Or once the region is up, if those exits are not running, there's another transaction that you can run, DTCXXO, and that will start the exits for debugging. For another subsystem, IMS, if you're running a message processing region where you're online entering transactions and you want to be able to debug non-LE programs in that environment, it's got to be set up a certain way. And basically what this ends up being is a front end to an IMS version of EQA-NMDBG that I mentioned in the first step. What you have to define when you start the message processing region, there's something called an application front end. And that needs to point to a module that we ship called EQANIAFE. And what happens is when you enter your transaction, this NIAFE is going to get control. And he is going to figure out if you're debugging this transaction and where to send the screens and all that, how to set up a test parameter, and then we'll call EQANIDBG, which will then call the program for your transaction. So once that's set up and the region is started, there is another transaction you have to use that actually tells debug tool that you want the screen, you know, the actual debug tool screens, they're not going to come back to your IMS terminal. You're either going to have to send them to a terminal interface manager screen or to the remote front end, like the GUI debugger that Jesse was talking about. So EQA set is the way to tell it what the user interface screen is going to be. So those are the kind of the two steps that you need for non-LE IMS transactions. So slide 22, please. Now, once debug tool has started, and you need to make, you know, you want to make sure that, or if things aren't working properly, there are a couple of things. Well, there's one thing that you need to do all the time, but then there's another thing you need to look for that can tell you that your environment's not quite right. And that is, in non-CICS environments, you can look for this message, EQA2458I, and as Randy mentioned, setting message ID on will help you to see the message number. But the message that you get with 2458i is that our SVC screening is not enabled. And that's important. SVC screening will see MVS load, MVS link, and MVS delete SVCs that occur on the system so that we will know when these programs are loaded or linked to, so that we can determine whether or not they're to be debugged. If SVC screening is not on, it's as though these things never happened and these programs didn't exist because we don't know they're there. For language environment programs, language environment actually calls debug tool. In this case, we need a mechanism to know that these programs are loaded or linked to be able to debug them. So if you see SVC screening is off and you're trying to debug non-LE, it's quite possible that your ability to do so will be very limited. In any event, for any non-LE compile unit, once the debugger is up, if you want to debug at a source level, you'll need to issue the load debug data command, and it's abbreviated as LDD. And quite simply, it's just LDD and then the program name and the CSEC name, essentially. And that basically recognizes it as a non-LE compile unit, and it, like it says here, will get the symbolic data, the source, and then you can debug it at a source level. So slide 23, please.
Thank you, Randy. So before we move on to question number 6, we just want to open the lines very quickly in case anyone has any questions for the first 5 pre-submitted questions.
Tina Ivany, your line is open.
This is Karen Ray in the Tina Ivany group. Is there a place where a previous user of Expeditor can get equivalent commands in debug?
This is Randy Kramer. I'll try to answer that. So initially, you want something that would say, like, go one is equivalent to step?
Something like that. We had trouble doing a when.
Okay.
And we don't have manuals here. We have little cheat sheets, but no manuals.
Okay.
And we've had Expeditor for at least 15 years. We went to debug, and so when somebody is debugging a program, let's say in an emergency situation, you don't want to be running around trying to figure out what do I say in debug.
Well, I guess the bottom line there is, one is all the manuals are on the web, so they are easy access, but There's nothing in any of the manuals that say this command is equivalent to this command in Expeditor, because there are other debuggers out there also. So we don't have anything like that. Now, I do know there are some during the training, some of the technical salespeople that go out in that, they basically have a preference file that will set debug tool up to look more like Expeditor. In other words, it will change PF keys from like step to go one.
Uh-huh.
It will change things that from a standpoint of something like list monitor, I think in Expeditor it's something like keep.
Yeah.
And it basically, so it sets debug tool up to look more like Expeditor. And we can probably get you something like that if you send an email to us, we can probably get you something like that. Now, it probably doesn't have every single command that Expeditor has is an equivalent, but it does have quite a few. The only thing bad about that is when something doesn't quite do what you want or you need to look something up, you're going to think in terms of an Expeditor command and not in terms of a debug tool command, which will make it hard to look up in the manual. But
yeah, I understand, but when you're switching over, you need a time period where you say in your head, okay, I do this in debugger.
Right. Understand, and that's why we came up with that equivalent preference file for a lot of the common type commands.
Okay. And where do we...
I think I should...
Oh, you can do it? Okay. We've got a guy here in our technical department who probably can get a hold of you and get that.
Yeah, if somebody can get a hold of us... if somebody can get a hold of us, or I think Bill's going to give his email out or something at the end, if you send him a note, then we can probably get you the file.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would be very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
And we currently have no additional questions.
Thank you, Jackie. I will now move on to question number 6, slide 23, and turn the presentation back to Randy.
Okay, this is Randy Kramer again. This is one of the questions that was emailed to us sort of towards the end, so we didn't really get to put the answer in the slide presentation, but the question is rather long, but let me read it. It says, when Debug Tools was first installed in our shop, we used transaction DTCN to define profiles. Then when we installed a Kix TS release that supported CADP, we tested with that since it allowed for multiple and persistent debugging profiles. However, testing with one vendor application sometimes failed, and although we worked with IBM for a short while to fix this, we never pursued it to resolution. We abandoned CADP because we believed that it was noted that future development would be in DTCN. While it's not an important issue, will the additional features of CADP be incorporated into DTCN? The answer here is CADP does allow you to, it does support multiple and persistent debugging profiles. Since I think it started in V10, not 100% sure, but DTCN now does handle persistent debugging profiles. Instead of DTCN using temporary storage queues, it uses a VSAM file, and you do have to do a little setup. It's in the customization guide if you want to use VSAM files. Now, although it's persistent, currently it does not store multiple profiles for an individual user. If that's something folks would like, then they can make a request, and we can basically add that support if we have people that are interested in that, but at this time, multiple profiles are not handled persistently. One of the things you do have to realize is DTCN is developed by Debug Tool and supported by Debug Tool, and CADP was developed by Kix and is supported by Kix. But CADP is, I think, pretty much in maintenance mode, and there won't be any new development there, where under DTCN, if you do have requests, Debug Tool will take those into consideration, and most of the time those do get added. Now, will additional features of CADP be incorporated into DTCN? I guess it depends on exactly which ones you're referring to, and if we know that, we can evaluate them and plan for them. So But right now, we do, like I said, we do have persistent debugging profiles in DTCN. If you set up the DTCN vSAM, you can have a persistent debug profile for a user. You just can't have multiple ones at this time yet. Just for folks' information, the persistent DTCN vSAM support, it actually went in V9, I was informed. Okay, so if anybody does need additional support in DTCN, whether it's something CADP has or something new, then there is a process to submit new requirements, and they'll be evaluated, and we'll look at them, we'll evaluate them, and hopefully we'll do them. Thank you. If you could move to slide 24, please. I'm going to go through question 7 here. This is still Randy Kramer. We seem to occasionally have to increase EDSA LIM to allow for programmer testing. And even though we use the set ignore link command, storage is sometimes quite large. Is this normal? Is there any way to estimate the amount of storage required for debug tool? Okay. For those that don't know, EDSA LIM, we're talking CICS here. But sometimes I guess there's even problems, whether be a region size in JCL or something like that. And is people wonder, you know, how much storage does debug tool need? To be quite honest with you, there are so many variables here, it definitely takes more storage, and it's really hard to determine that because so many things, there are so many variables. Obviously, when you debug tool needs to load its key load modules in the storage. It needs to build its critical control blocks. It also has to load, bring into memory the source or listing file and the debug data. And a lot of that really varies depending on the size of the application. I mean, if you have a program that's 20 lines long versus one that has 250,000 lines, definitely there's more storage for the big program. And it also has to bring in things if you're using auto monitor for variables. There's miscellaneous storage for when people set breakpoints or issue commands. So there's definitely the storage will increase with debug tool. Now, how large will that be? Again, that really depends on what you're doing. You know, if you monitor a variable that is extremely large, we're going to get a lot of storage. So it's, I don't have a definitive answer there. It really depends. And I hate to say that, but it's so application dependent that I can't give a cookie cutter answer here. And if anybody from debug, other people on the line from debug tool, if they have any comments on that, please feel free, or I think at this time you ought to open the line for questions, and if we need to discuss this one more, we can.
Uma Vaiwachan, your line is open.
With version 9, I used to give the transaction ID, and DTCN used to automatically pick up the transaction and start the debug. But now, even if I give the transaction and specify the load module, it doesn't pick it up.
Okay, this is Randy Kramer. I'll try to answer that one. Okay. That could be one of a couple things. First, so with V9, I assume you were putting your transaction in and you were putting the name of the program and the program ID.
Correct.
Okay. Now we have the load module and CU name. It should pick it up, but the first thing I would probably warn you about, the load module name is, do you know if the load module name is the initial load module or is it at link level boundary? Is it linked to or given control through XCTL or is it via a call?
I just put an asterisk there for the load module.
Okay. Okay, so you put an asterisk for the load module and then did you put the CU name in or?
Yes, I put the CU name, program I wanted, yeah.
And it didn't stop?
No, it didn't. Okay. But when I took out the transaction ID, it stopped.
Oh. Okay. Oh, okay. Now, there was a, I think, do you know what maintenance level you're at? This may be a service problem that you may not be at the current service level. I think the best thing to do in this case would probably be to open a what's called a PMR, a problem management report, through service so we could address that to see if it's a service problem or a it could be a new bug. We don't know, but we need to collect some more information on that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We have no additional questions.
Thank you, everyone, for your participation in the live Q&A period. At this point in time, I'm going to move on to slide 27 and pass the presentation over to Bill for a summary of today's session.
Thank you, Joseph. Well, we covered a lot of topics today. There's quite a few questions, and we really appreciate all the questions that were sent in and asked via the phone lines. At this point, if you have any additional questions or comments or didn't get to ask your question, please feel free to send me an email. My email is down at the bottom, myjack, M-Y-J-A-K, at us.ibm.com. Actually, on page 28, there are a lot of debug tool links. So, and I know that I point a lot of customers to these particular links to help with identifying problems and getting things resolved. So, again, if you have any questions, feel free to send me an email. Okay, back to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Bill, for a wonderful summary. At this point in time, we will conclude the Ask the Expert session.